This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Welcome to Foundation and Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Foundation on Apple TV+. This episode, we're considering feedback for Season 1, Episode 10, The Leap. Respect and enjoy the podcast. All right, Aaron. How do we do in the feedback department this week? In the season finale?
We got a bunch. I think I'm also going to dispense with the Goyer foyer because we're going to have a whole second Goyer floor to this wrap-up podcast.
That's true, yeah.
Because we have got with him and his assistant. We've got something scheduled for tomorrow as the recording schedule goes. I'm not sure what the release is going to be, but we'll have a whole section on his thoughts. But a lot of people had a lot of thoughts wrapping up season one here. So maybe we can just get going on that. Again, foundationofballmove.com is how you get in touch with the show, but we are going to steal away like thieves in the night to open up the foundation shop. Will close, move 6 feet down the road, and reopen under a new name called Beltaloda, the officially unofficial podcast for Expanse. And we're gonna be talking about another epic sci-fi show just in a couple weeks. So if you haven't gotten your fill of sci-fi, please come back, or I'll make it easy on you. Search for Bald Move Pulp on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to that thing. And then everything we talk about with ray guns, spaceships, things like that, you'll get it. You'll be instantly aware. First up is R. Rolson. I can only assume they're a robot.
Yes.
Adhering to the Asimovian naming convention. So you take everything with a robotic grain of salt. Was listening to your last visit to the Goyer foyer and your discussion about the Harry Seldon and the Invictus, which got me thinking. Is benefited Terminus, its immediate neighbors have been devastated. The Foundation's able to grow because Anacreon and Thespis were weakened. Could Harry be more behind the fall of the Starbridge than we first thought? Demerzel tells Dawn that Day's response to the destruction of the Starbridge and the punishment of the two worlds is always the Empire's response, so Harry might have predicted the response Empire would take and place the Foundation there. It definitely puts a potentially darker spin on Harry, but with the time and numbers he's working with, he might see the death of hundreds of millions in comparison to the lives of trillions and feel it's a price worth paying.
Right, it's the ultimate justification. It's like, oh, we got trillions of lives hanging in the balance. Of course we can blow up a few billion people.
It's the utilitarian logic, yeah.
Right. I don't know, we've speculated about the idea that he might have been behind that attack, but we haven't really taken it then to its logical conclusion, I guess, which would be that, yeah, he wanted to be placed there near these sort of half-destroyed empires that wouldn't be able to challenge them as much. Although I would argue, perhaps, if I'm playing devil's advocate here, that you could be better placed in terms of that, because if you had some, you know, planets that were still loyal to Empire, you might not be having these problems right now.
But what do you mean you wouldn't be having these problems?
I mean, there would be no threat of Terminus being destroyed, and I don't know, right? Because this is all like, oh, but maybe Harry wants Terminus to be under threat. Maybe that's necessary as a catalyst for, I don't know, killing Lewis or something, so the Foundation can get on with their work. I don't know.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Because, like, the thing, I guess, to that is, you're right, the Foundation wouldn't be under any threat, but clearly the Foundation has to become something more than what it is.
Exactly,
to satisfy Harry's plans. And there's also, I want to acknowledge there's levels to this. There's levels of culpability behind, like, Harry literally is the super secret mastermind that blew up the space bridge, that Demerzel with Oliver. Fantastic powers and the finances and resources of the Empire behind her could not unravel. It could be that he just predicted that would happen. And instead of giving the Empire concrete and actionable things like, hey, they're going to blow up the space bridge and you need to beef up security. And my predictions say it's the chances are going to peak in this certain year or season or whatever. He just says, the Empire's fucked, and you know, it's unavoidable. I mean, that's the thing. Like, Harry even admits that this fall could be delayed. And if you can mm-hmm. delay it, then maybe you could, you know, plan for it better, or maybe you could shrink that 30,000 years to 1,000 to maybe 500 years. Maybe you could avoid it at all. I think it's telling that only Harry has those answers.
Yeah,
you know?
For sure.
So like that is less, you know, culpable than the guy actually pulling the lever. But like also he is being kind of a bit of a smarty pants know it all. I know better than you. I mean, that's the whole idea behind in principle, I don't have any problem with something that will sacrifice 600 million lives to save 8 trillion. You know, it seems like good math. But ideally, you would be in a situation where it's like a trolley problem, where it's like, well, it's one or the other, so you have to choose. Or you have a situation like in Chernobyl, where they ask for volunteers to, you know, essentially go into radioactive water and sacrifice your life to save perhaps a billion. Like, if you have the consent mm-hmm. of the people, the doomed people, that's something too. But like, I don't know, there is something bloodless about what Harry is doing at a galactic scale.
No, it's all squeaky. If he is like actually, you know, if he's an accelerationist here pushing events forward,
there you go.
That becomes very sticky ethically. But I don't know. I'm not here to judge the morality or the ethics of Harry Seldon. Although that's interesting topic, I guess the question is like, is Terminus a place he wanted to be specifically because he knew what was coming? I don't know. I don't feel like I got an indication of that in the book, and I don't feel like I got an indication of that in the show either.
Yeah, that's a good point when you talk about it, because that's the kind of a debate we're having right now. Uh-huh. Like a lot of people, like almost, you can't find almost anyone that says we have no problems today or not even severe problems.
Right.
The disagreements are between people like, yeah, but we need to make a tweak or two and then we'll be back on track versus people we need mm-hmm. to make major systemic changes or we won't get back on track versus this is doomed. Yeah. And what we should do is like kick the legs, the rotten legs out from underneath this rotten table, have it collapse. And the faster that happens, the faster we can build back something better.
Right.
And who the fuck is right? Like, I don't know. But if you're convinced that the system is irredeemably fucked and it's going to collapse anyway, then morally, aren't you? I mean, like, I don't know. Everything gets really I'm not that confident in anything to be like, well, fuck it. Yeah, let's just have a revolution and see what happens with the you know, the weaker segments of society. See how they go through that cataclysm. Like, I am very hesitant to do something like that. And a guy like Harry, who is so sure. But I guess that's the thing, is like, he's got math. Like,
sure,
he can literally like Rick from Rick and Morty, he can go to a whiteboard and prove how fucked you are with math. That's the thing that makes it, I guess, a little more than maybe just egocentric grandstanding.
It's the thing that makes me trust him. It's the thing that makes him a protagonist instead of an antagonist in this. That is literally it, because everything else he's doing seems very scary.
Mm-hmm. And that's like, you know, again, versus whether he's passively accepting this collapse because, mm-hmm. you know, he's, or whether he's actively trying to engineer it to happen quicker because he thinks that's going to, it is like you said, it's all just kind of icky.
Morally. He's definitely doing that, right? I mean, he admits that to Gale. He says that this could go on much longer. So he is accelerating events. It's just like, what means is he using to accelerate events? Is he using terrorist attacks? Is he using, you know, the setting up of the foundation? Like, what are the things, the levers he's controlling here?
Oh, I mean, just revealing, in my mind, just revealing the fact that the Empire is fucked and I can prove it mathematically is an acceleration of events.
It can't be.
There's no way it could be like a slowing of the events, but. I'm sure all that stuff is going to be, that stuff is going to be explored in upcoming seasons. It has to be. That's what's where all the really thorny, and tricky issues are.
True.
John in California says, could you clarify the whole Harry Seldon transfer of consciousness condition? Is it like in the show Altered Carbon, where a person's waking consciousness is actually transferred to a different body with nothing of their consciousness remaining in the previous body? Or is it just a copy of the person's memories and thought patterns placed into an AI supercomputer that then begins to think and act like a person? If it's the latter, then the real Harry bled out and died on the floor of the ship, and AI Harry is only doing a copy doing its best to think like the real dead Harry and make Harry-like decisions based on its copied memories of Harry. This also seems to be in line with how the Empire line is being maintained. Each backup clone copy is just like the AI computer and getting real-time memories loaded into it just in case of an emergency break glass scenario. Your thoughts?
Mm-hmm. I think it's not like Altered Carbon. I don't think it's... Well, no, it is. It is kind of like Altered Carbon, too, because in Altered Carbon, it was only illegal to make copies of yourself. It wasn't impossible. There were a lot of characters that did make multiple copies of themselves. And Harry, there are two Harry Seldons now, right? If you think that...
I was about to say, yeah, we have a copy situation already.
Right. If you think that those copies are as good as the original, and I think in at least one of those cases, they probably are, then yeah, you've got multiple copies of him. So I think he's a digital file now that can be copied and pasted into any computer sufficient to process his whatever file. I don't know. It's a zip file, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I wonder, I don't think these are identical copies because there was something wrong in the transfer process. Right. It was an incomplete, the one that we saw on board the, Harry's personal ship going to Helicon versus, I guess, the complete, the unhurried, had the mental thing, had the nanites dissolving his brain and reading it neuron by neuron. Like, that seems to be a difference there. But yeah, I don't know what that means. And also, like, it's not clear to me how perfect these copies are. It seems to me like they already introduced this concept of like, well, the Empire has got these perfect processes of clones and it's perfect genetic dynasty. And it's like, it's flawless and it's well thought out and it's airtight. And they blew that the fuck up in the last two episodes, right? None of that's true. It's been compromised. Even the source has been compromised. The transfers aren't perfect. It's been, or if they were, they were undone by nanotechnology. It's almost like Malcolm in Jurassic Park, like life finds a way. Like maybe the thesis of this show is that life wants to be kind of wild and individual and expressive. And by putting it into like these rigid boxes, like the genetic dynasty, that that's inevitable. It's going to collapse. You can't have these perfect copies of individuals. But that also bodes ill for the Foundation project, right? Like if life finds a way and tries to express individuality and this is a psychohistory that works on mass numbers of people and it doesn't account for individuality, then... Is that not another box you're trying to squeeze humanity into? Like all of them? What do you do with the outliers?
Yeah.
And not to spoil anything, but explicitly later books are about things like that. How do you, this is stuff we haven't talked about since like episode 3 or 4, but in a branch of science like psychohistory, how do you predict things? And I threw off the things off the top of my head, like how do you predict something like Gale evolving telepathy or some kind of precognition? How do you deal with an exogalactic threat that you had no way? Yeah. It's just a variable, an unknown variable on the board. Later books are about how clever ways that you can have fail safes and backup plans. But even then, there's got to be a limit to it, right?
Oh, sure. You know? Yeah. Yeah, that's why those unknown unknowns are so dangerous, right? To your plan.
Right.
Like, you just can't account for them.
If a galaxy-sized Galactus just wandered by and he eats galaxies, I don't think Harry's got a plan for that, I think humanity just
probably
dies.
Not.
Just gets digested into this hypothetical being. So,
yeah, I'm sure there are outcomes where none of this survives, right?
Yeah. Oh, there's got to be like even Harry's like psychohistory. There's probably a not insignificant probability that this thing all just fails and you got 30,000 years of dark ages or worse. Mm-hmm. It's just he's trying really hard not steer towards that condition, I guess.
Sure.
All right, let's move on to Ryan. So the real question is, how do you have a tech to fit a rigid hull boat in a duffel bag, but you still have to paddle it? That's a great question. We can't have like a Minn Kota electric outboard with this thing, solar powered.
Right.
You can't have it like nano motors. It just kind of like you vibrate the surface and go. You got to pedal this thing like a goddamn 18th century farmer. Come on.
Yeah, they need to put an engine on it that like splits the hydrogen atoms out of the water and then uses that to power the propeller. That's the ultimate boat power source.
Yeah. I do think that's funny. Yeah, you can have a magic kayak,
right?
But it cannot be propelled. Rhino says, I've read the first two books in the Foundation series and I listened to them again as audiobooks to prepare for the show. I'll keep my opinion short and sweet. I'm loving this adaptation. I have very few quibbles with the season. I found for the most part, the final episode brought things together nicely and opened up the potential for seasons to come. I'm really excited for how interesting the Clone Dynasty declining may become. The secret that is Demerzel, the reveal of the mule. I'm really curious if they're more directly going to confront Harry about the potential that his methods risk him becoming a different side of the same Cleon coin. Kind of strikes with what we've talked about so far. But I wanted to throw... Like, I think there is this bias that if you've read the books, you hate the show. And if you're ignorant of the books, then maybe you like the show for doing whatever it's doing. And while it's true I haven't read these books in 30-some years, I did read the core books and had a lot of affection for them. And I dig what this is doing. I know you read the first book just weeks before the show started. Mm-hmm. And I think you're on board with what the show's doing.
Yeah.
And Rhino here is, too. We will have some negative feedback here towards the end of the podcast. So if you're waiting for us to discuss that, it's coming. But we're trying to get the love out of the way and the questions before we get to the just disappointment and frustration. But yeah, like that's I don't know how self-aware Harry is, you know, like. If some rando guy just like came up and said, I've invented a new branch of mathematics that proves that society is doomed and we have to radically reorganize it to my prescriptions or we're all fucked. I would think that person is a nut job.
Yeah.
But you have to accept it, like at least in the early goings of Foundation, as like fact or the story just doesn't work.
Like, yes. But that's no different than any other work of fiction, right? You have to accept the premise. If you don't accept the premise, then none of the it's pointless to read or view the rest of it.
Yeah. And is it because like, there's some crackpot shit we got right now. We got, you know, Flat Earth has come back. There's that Time Cube guy. I guess it would be more interesting if like there was 30 or 40 leading, you know, the physicists. That would be like, you know, we've actually looked at this guy's equations and, you know, maybe time is a cube if you look at it a certain way. And some of these things we could test and like, you know, we've done some tests at the Large Hadron Collider and we collided a bunch of large hadrons. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, damn, cubes, whew, time's looking pretty squared and cubed, man. I don't know what to tell you. And I think that's the other thing that the book and the series done well is the fact that like, all of the other branches of the science, maybe they're not on board with the psychohistory, but no one can just like, you know, do a debunking of this guy's work. Like,
sure.
It's truly one of those things where it's like it's brand new thought and, you know, we don't like it, but we're having a hard time poking holes into it. Evan G says about that theory of rebellious dawn and empire switching with the real dawn. Never mind. It was a great theory, though.
Uh-huh.
I really like the idea of the clone. But that's the other thing is kind of it came true because it turns out it's all compromised clones, mm-hmm. perhaps all the way down to the original Cleon.
For sure. I think like that idea, though, spawned out of the freshly nanobotted Dawn having his throat cut. And so we were like looking for loopholes. Okay, how could this work? Because we know that the nanobots repair damage very quickly, faster than you would bleed out. But like, yeah. So maybe in retrospect, like I now don't, I don't understand the neck cutting, the throat cutting, how that could actually kill him if he's got the nanobots in him. But I don't know. Maybe they got to be like reactivated or something. Who knows?
Well, it's something that I'm definitely got a question to ask for the man himself, the
Yeah, lawyer. Sounds like it.
But I like the theory, and I also like mm-hmm. the fact that the clones were compromised, and now you've got a situation where, you know, like Dusk, for all his grandstanding about you're not a Kleon, you don't have the stuff, you are an abomination. Like it would be hilarious if they're all that, you know. And what does sure. that do to their surety in the genetic dynasty? And the fact, yeah, it's gonna be funny. Sewell says, I can't tell you how much I loved episode 10, from the visuals of Synax's rings on the water to the season cliffhangers to the emotions of Dimmerzel, Revenge of the Machines. All of it was just really well done, and I can't wait to see season 2. But I do have one gripe. The Empire brought up, and I'm sure taught all political machinations, manners, maneuvering in public, dialect, blah, blah, blah. But the one thing that struck me in 9 and 10 was how absolutely helpless former brother Don was. Like, he was a sullen child that couldn't defend himself at even a toddler level. He just sat there and cried. Why on earth would he trade his shield for that shitty coat, man? Trade your shoes or something. You'd think these guys would be trained to be world-wrecking machines at the prime. Brother Day's like a 6'8 chiseled brick house. You wouldn't need that shield because you wouldn't test that man. Brother Don, 0 out of 3 badass. He's referring to yeah. our badass scale. And if you want to know more about that, just search Bald Move Badass, and you'll find all you can handle. Do you think there's something to the man baby that is Don? Does that say something about the Empire as a whole?
I mean, it definitely has me wondering when exactly they turn into Lee Pace. Yeah, like I'm with you there. This one didn't seem on that track. And maybe that's the point. Maybe this one is very different, right? Not just the, you know, what hand he uses to pick up his wine and being colorblind. Maybe he just doesn't have the aptitude for whatever he was being put through. I don't know.
I wonder if Kleon the First was a conqueror, like a great, you know, because he's that's the other thing is like Kleon the First was not, I don't think he conquered shit. I think he just happened to be at the head of the Empire and mm-hmm. he had the Starbridge idea. And he's like, I'm so awesome that I just there's no more other people, no more sons. I just going to be me for the rest of all time. Because there's a lot of things like in real medieval history, like it was illegal to hit a royal person to the extent that like if you had a prince that was naughty, you had a literal, the term whipping boy came from the fact that you would take a friend and you'd introduce this, you know, you'd raise these two boys together. So they loved each other like brothers. They were best friends. And whenever the prince did something naughty, you'd beat the holy fuck out of his best friend. And that is how you enforce discipline. Like, you know, if you raise the kid with empathy, then he would not want his friend to get hurt so that he, you know, wow. But that's how they got around that loophole. And I always wondered, you know, especially when you get into the later, you know, when you've gone away from Charlemagne and you've gone away from some of these other great, like literal, you know, they're essentially kings, but they're essentially upjumped kind of just tribal chieftains that gotten some armies together and they do legitimately kick ass. You get several lines and they've never been beat and you can't really raise a sword against them and all this other shit. Like, how good on the battlefield were they, you know, all the way to like, you know, King George and the American colonies. He was like half like inbred and insane. Like, I doubt he would be very good on the battlefield. And now imagine these people with like impenetrable force fields.
Yeah.
Where like, and also if you kill one of them, it's cool, that'll crack out another one out of deep storage. Like, are these guys trained at martial stuff at all?
It's a good question. I don't really know why they would need to be,
but they hunt with weapons, so like that's not martial, you know.
I suppose. Yeah, you probably have a better shot against them in hand-to-hand combat versus having a shootout with him.
But I don't know how. And also, I was thinking when I was reading this email, it's like, is it that stupid to give away the shield bracelet, because if you're trying to make your way through a crowd and every time someone, in the underbelly of this society, and every time someone jostles you, flare gold, like, mm-hmm. you know, was that that's not a great way to like stay undercover. Right. It's probably easy to track, sure. you know, easier than even nanobots, maybe. Yeah. And then, like, as far as him being a baby, like, it was a lot. The fact that you think you're the love of your life is actually super secret in love with your evil clone. You have an evil clone. This evil clone is going to kill you and take over your family from the inside, which, you know, fucked up relationship or not. This is Day's brother, dad, grandpa we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
you know, and his mommy, his robot mommy. So I feel like a lot of people, when their world is falling down to that extent, and it's such a 180 from what they thought they were getting into, might have like that kind of breakdown.
Could be, yeah.
I don't know. We'll see. We'll see if they do weapons training. Like but that's the other thing, is like, even the next season, like 183 years in the future, if you see Lee Pace, you know, whipping people's ass with some kind of space bow staff, like, is that the way they always did it, or is that a reaction to current events? Who knows? Sierra, something small but very striking that I appreciated in the finale was the view after dusk through his paint tray at the mural. The camera stays on the chroma as all the colors shift and the picture is manipulated by random colors thrown onto it. Not only is this clearly showing dusk's disdain for Dawn, but to have this shot right before the Shadow Master tells Day that Cleon's DNA has been altered at the source was a great illustration of how their perfect picture has been ruined. Mm. Bravo to Goyer and his crew for a fantastic first season.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I think that's one of the things that really attracted me to the show and kept me engaged through some otherwise uneven stuff, is that they do kind of nail this stuff. And it also wouldn't surprise me if you rewatch season one, knowing everything that you do that you do now, if more and more of that type of symbolism jumped out at you.
Yeah.
You know, because clearly, like, you know, like the idea that Dawn painting over his baby mural, you know, seemed like just mm-hmm. like rebellious teenage shit or like callow youth type of shit. But then find out he's colorblind several episodes later. Like, how many other things like that did we just miss because we were enthralled with whatever mystery du jour was, you know?
Sure. Or not even miss, because we talked about that. But yeah, they just become richer.
Yeah,
as you view them through the lens of everything we know now.
Yeah. Move on to Steven. Says, first time, long time, love your podcast and other content. You guys have inspired me to watch certain shows just to be able to hear your commentary. Keep up the great work. Well, thank you for the high praise, Steven. I have two questions about season 10. Do you think Dimrizel killing brother Dawn was largely a fuck you to Day for making her kill Zephyr Halima? She claims she killed Dawn out of loyalty to the Empire, but it also seemed like an act of defiance to me.
I'm going to go with the laws, the robot laws on this, because I think they're at play here, certainly. So, yeah, I think this was exactly what we thought it was. She's doing this for the Empire.
There's also room for like it to. Yeah, that's my answer too. That you got the laws. I think they're hearing through the laws. I think that, you know, when Dimrizel gets cut or gets like a big piece of shit falling on her and laser open the collarbone, she probably receives signals, like, you know, Arnold said in Terminator, that it could be, you know, perceived as pain, or like you could think of them as pain, but they're probably not pain like us humans feel. And she has feelings of emotions, especially when they're like all of her different laws are conflicting, you know, like, you know, you shouldn't kill a person, conflicting with loyalty to the Empire, conflicting with the Zeroth law, which is you have to protect and do what's in the best interest for humanity as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if those are emotions the way we feel, but, you know, clearly they affect her in a powerful way. You know, they make her self-destructive. They make her self-harm. They make her scream as she pulls the skin off of her skull, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But is that what we feel like when we betray like a deeply held ideal? I don't know. And how could you, you know, it's like you got a consciousness gap there.
Sure.
I mean, if you dig deep enough in philosophy, you don't even know that anyone's real. Like, you could just be a fucking brain in a jar and everything's a simulation. And, you know, like, how much leaps do you want to make in granting humanity to your fellow man and, like, humanity to the animals we should, and all that stuff is kind of up for debate. But secondly, I wonder if Brother Day truly killed all those people in Azura's orbit. This episode demonstrated that he does have a shred of empathy. Also, considering that Azura would never know the truth due to her lifetime sentence in solitude, couldn't he inflict the desired psychological torture on her without actually murdering all those people? We never know, but I love this series shows enough shades of gray in each character to make one wonder. Day's breakdown at the end of the episode was one of my favorite scenes in the series, largely because of the character building that preceded it.
I did wonder that myself. You know, when he twists his fingers, we don't like see an insert shot of anything happening. We're just left in Azura's place to imagine it. So, yeah, he could have possibly just, you know, that could have just been an emotional knife he was using and not something that actually happened.
I think it's funny because, like, a good number of people wrote in with the same question, and some people even said if they wanted us to know for sure that he killed these people, then mm-hmm. you know, obviously, since she worked with a bunch of people in the garden, you could have had a gardener back there just kind of pruning shit and just collapse, you know.
Sure.
Like, when he did the thing. So why would they leave it ambiguous? As a person who never even considered that it was ambiguous, I guess I don't have an answer, because, like, to me, the other question is why would Day take pity on her that way?
Yeah, he doesn't seem like that kind of guy.
Yeah, like, he seemed really really charged up about the fact that she's killed his legacy, he's going to kill her legacy. And as far as the, you know, people like, oh, the 1,800 innocent people, like, what's interesting about the fact that this is 8 trillion people in the galaxy is, so, like, this is essentially 1,000 times bigger than Earth. You know, mm-hmm. so you can just, you know, easily divide or multiply by 1,000 to get the kind of thing. So, like, imagine the president of the United States wants to really fuck with someone's life, and you say, you know, he's going to kill 1.8 people.
Mm-hmm.
That is just not going to be noticed. I'm sorry. Like, that's just a random accident that someone just got murdered or mugged in a side of the road. Like, no one's going to. So, like, 1,800 people sounds like a lot, but an 8 billion people in a place that has total control like Trantor, I don't know that it's all that much. Yeah. And I think that, like, Brother Day has got, like, the beginning of empathy for some of his subjects and all that, and but, like, I don't know. I guess the other question I had is, like, how is it public knowledge? Like, What is more useful to the Empire? Getting out the message that someone tried to infiltrate a genetic dynasty and failed, and that we extinguished everyone they ever knew and loved because of that? Or the fact that, like, we're not going to suffer a significant attack, you know, 2 significant attacks within 30 years, and we're just bulletproof? Which is the thing that Empire would most like to project?
I feel like they'd most like to project the status quo, that none of this has ever happened.
Me too.
Yeah, that no one would even find out that there was an attempt to sabotage the first Kleon, let alone that it worked.
Yeah. So if you're not worried about sending a message, then it's just fucking with the person's brain. And I guess that's a stronger argument that maybe Day didn't have it done. But, like,
I don't know that it matters
to do it, you know?
So much, right? I get that it's a different thing if he did it versus if he didn't. Mm-hmm. It tells you something about who he is, about his empathy, about. Yeah, there's an important bit there, but because the show doesn't tell us, you're free to speculate. You're free to think, oh, he's too empathetic for that. He wouldn't kill these people just because. This happened with this other one person, and he doesn't need to kill them. So why would he? You're free to take your guesses there. And I don't think we're going to come back and revisit this. So I don't think we'll ever get an actual answer. To me,
that's a good point.
I came away from it thinking
gone or day.
Right. I came away from it thinking with the question mark, like, oh, maybe he didn't actually kill them, but I'm going with the show telling me that he did. So, like, I'm just going to lean into that.
Yeah, I mean, you've got so the question we have is, like, is he individually sadistic or is he sadistic on, like, a group level, you know, group mm-hmm. punishment level? Because, like, what he did to Zura is pretty fucking epic revenge, regardless of whether he actually carried it, because it's real to her.
Yeah.
And I guess it would have been, you know, maybe the only thing that makes me question about whether we'll find out or not is, like, it is such a baller idea to have Azura still alive and, like, you know, 50 years from now escaping from prison as some old crazy woman.
Yeah.
And leading some kind of resistance at the same time that the, you know, the empire is maximally genetically, divergent. And so, you know, and like, could she draw a source of strength from, like, but wait a minute. You know, he said he killed everybody, but I didn't see anyone die in the garden. And like, I went into my ISO chamber hopeful that, like, you know, or just defiant, knowing that if I can outlast this or something. I don't know. But here I'm basing, this is what happens. We start basing theories on your fucking headcanon, your fan fiction.
Right.
Because none of that actually happened on screen. And that's just me being in love with the idea of what the fuck a person would come out. 60 sure. years from total sensory isolation, stewing on revenge. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, a lot of people were wondering about it. That's what we think. Who knows? Garrett says, Demerzel serves the Empire, but if Empire is defined as a specific genetic composition, then could this mean that Demerzel does not have to serve anyone who has corrupted genes? I think there might be a strong argument for this. Could also explain things like her killing Dawn and her kneeling on Maiden and not fully supporting Day, assuming he's also genetically corrupted. Remember the evasive answer she gave about how she can only support Empire? This could explain that as well. How fucking literal is Demerzel when she's talking about serving the Empire?
I don't think it's super literal. I mean, the laws don't even apply to Empire, right? They apply to humanity as a whole. And whatever she thinks, whether she could get the idea in her head, I guess, that humanity is better served by there being no empire and go on a killing spree and take out the cloning facility and all the Kleons. And that might be well within her programming. So I think, like, there's a lot of room here for Demerzel to act in all kinds of ways. But to me, like, the empire concept, is just that, a concept. It's not any one person. It's not any one Kleon. And I don't think, therefore, that any kind of genetic tampering would mean that she no longer views any one of these as empire.
The other thing is, like, Demerzel's been alive for over 10,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she's been loyal to the Empire for a good chunk of that, like, or at least nothing has said otherwise. So I wonder if we're hyper focusing on this, like, very, you know, this genetic dynasty, even though it's been gone on for 400 years, it's also just the very, very tail end.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, if we're talking about all of human history, we're talking about, like, you know, the last 5 minutes or so, you know, of existence,
right.
These 400 years. So, like, I don't know, because and even then, saying she serves the Empire, what does that mean? She's programmed the loyalty. She's presumably programmed with the other three laws. Presumably she's programmed with the zeroth law. More and more, I wonder, like, you know, there's that line in the third, I think it's the third episode, where Kleon the First is talking about the Star Bridge and the completion and how, like, Demerzel hasn't been around as much anymore. And she says, well, you've set a powerful task in front of the Empire's programmers, or there's a lot of systems programming to be done. I wonder if, like, sneaky Goyer was having us think it's a Star Bridge, but they're actually talking about changes they made to Demerzel's personality through programming, which could explain some of her strange behavior 400 years later, that, like, they've added this extra wrinkle that she's loyal to this particular genetic dynasty, and that law is warring with all her other laws.
Maybe he was trying to future-proof the clone dynasty by also modifying Demerzel and her laws. I don't know. It's a possibility, but yeah, the show has not directly said anything about that yet.
Just wrote that down as something to ask Goyer about.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
All right, let's move on to Neil from Australia. Does Harry's vault ever open again? Isn't the Prime Radiant the key, or did I miss something? If Salvor takes the Prime Radiant to Synax, which is countless light years away, doesn't that cause a few issues? Maybe I just don't have my head wrapped around the time jumps that we'll have to constantly deal with in the show. If the Prime Radiant is the key, then Harry will not reappear for a long time because Salvor was in stasis for well over a century, and then she would somehow have to get back to Terminus. I don't know. I think Neil's right on the money here. Let me ask you this first. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the Prime Radiant will be required to unlock the vault each and every time? Or do you think that was just a first time thing? Or do you think it would have opened regardless after a sufficient amount of time? Or
like, oh boy, what do I say about this that isn't spoilery? I guess if you haven't read any of the books and really don't want to know anything about them, skip ahead 20 seconds. Mm-hmm. Cause yeah, we know that the vault opens again, but there is no Prime Radiant in the book. So like it certainly could be a key that's needed each time.
And also it's not like this thing. It's not like Selden's Chatty Cathy. Like they go through some fairly long time periods between that vault opening
for sure. Know? So but 138 years. Whew, that's a lot longer than I would have expected.
It wouldn't blow my hair back if it was 138 years, but also okay. It wouldn't shock me if I don't know, because Salvor looks like she hasn't aged more than possibly a decade. So I wonder if there's going to be. Well, I'll put it this way. Gale took a detour between her getting, you know, going from the Deliverance to Synax, right? She went to the Helicon ship, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then she put herself back in stasis, and it's quite possible that Salvor might do that as well. She might be investigating where her mom, it could be she's leaning on intuition, she goes right to Synax, but she could bop around and do a little bit of investigation, and who knows whether she comes back with the Prime Radiant or not, or maybe we just there's going to be 138 years until Harry pops off. Like, I think Goyer's working with a plan of a, he's going to try to explore the full 1,000-year time period that, you know, like of the downfall of the Galactic Empire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the books themselves, I think, only make it like 500 some years.
Not all the way.
So it could be that, like, this is kind of like if you squint and take 1,000 years and divide it by 8, it's kind of sort of right in that time period where, if Harry makes an appearance once per season to solve a crisis or something like that, then that math kind of works out. Like, okay, 130 mm-hmm. years in the future is about right where you want to be. So, but they're taking a lot of liberties with the books. So
they are. Yeah. It makes it hard to predict anything, which I kind of like.
Yeah. Yeah. The first crisis happened, I think, earlier than in the books chronologically.
Yep.
In a different place, but like it, and then I think the next crisis was not 138 years later, but like, mm-hmm. you know, that's just a timeline that we know they're fucking with. So I don't know. I don't know if it's a problem. And the fact is, we just know that eventually Gale and Salvor will end up on Synax 138 years from our prime timeline that we've been through most of the season, but we don't know what Salvor was doing for that full 138 years. Moving on to Ari, says, hey guys, I have a fan theory for Aaron who loves his theories. Gale has mentioned a recurring vision that she's had of her as a child, swimming in endless water at night when the black hole suddenly appears in the horizon and a tidal wave takes her over. What if this old vision is actually a future vision of the Invictus jumping in the orbit of Synax? It create what appears to Gale to be a sudden black hole, but it's actually just the Invictus jump drive. Mm. I'd imagine that the Invictus jumped close enough to Synax, even outside its orbit, it'd probably cause some form of tidal wave, considering the whole planet is made of water. If it happened to jump inside its atmosphere, well, that feels like it'd be a bad idea, but we've seen Battlestar Galactica jump in and out of atmosphere, too, before exploding the planet. And what's the Invictus doing there? Well, let's first take this. I don't know that I find it plausible that the Invictus would cause a tidal wave, because we see that in the Empire at Trantor, those things jump in fairly reasonable orbit all the fucking time. And if there's that much tidal forces on the planet, it would fuck things up. Now, maybe Trantor's got anti-tidal force fuckers, you know.
Does Trantor have any water? I don't know.
Yeah, but that kind of gravity pulls on everything. Like the Earth's crust has a tidal. It's just mm-hmm. measured in millimeters, and you can't really detect it, right? Might even be less than that. So like something like a black hole appearing in orbit hundreds of times a day, I think would fuck with people's perceptions even. So I guess I just don't think now. And the other thing is, like, it's also important to note that Hugo's thing going behind the sun and doing a simulated jump does not create a devastating thing in the sun. It just produces a signal that's indistinguishable from the devastating thing that's mm-hmm. the super flare from happening.
Yeah.
So like, I don't really think it does that much fuckery to the planet. It's just like, if you're, you know, 50,000 light years away, like you would be in Trantor at the middle of the galaxy, it would look like something had happened.
Yeah. And it's like one of those,
the look.
Yeah. Micro black holes, you know, that we were worried about the Large Hadron Collider creating. Yeah, it's not going to do that much damage. But I like the idea that this is a ship, a jump drive capable ship. I don't think it would be Invictus, right? Does it use the same method to jump?
I think it uses a singularity. It could be. You still have to be.
Maybe it could be, and that would make sense, right? If Hugo's out there looking for Salvor, because she's been gone 50 years or something, and, you know, he's been jumping around and in stasis himself, and so he's like 20, 30 years older or something, and Yeah, I think this could all work out to where, yeah, he might jump into Synax looking for her, and that could be their way off the planet. Because right now, I'm not sure they have a way off the planet. I don't know what happened to Salvor's ship. We'll see, I guess.
They got to find Kevin Costner. Get off this water world. Find dry land. And I guess there's something a part of me that I don't like that necessarily every dream and hunch that Gale has is going to come literally true.
Mm-hmm.
Like some things can just be night. Like, I mean, the fair rebuttal of that is like everything, literally everything we've seen has been some kind of connection. So why wouldn't this be? But also, I also like the idea that, like, you know, maybe you're sometimes you have a hunch and it's just wrong. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes you have a nightmare and it doesn't mean anything. You know, like if you're psychic or a precog, does that mean like every dream means something? Or do you have some dreams of like doing your homework assignment naked in front of the class just because, you know, sure, you're human?
Yeah,
you're
still like normal human dreams.
Yeah.
It's a good question. I feel like it doesn't work in fiction as well to sort of muddy those waters, unless that's your intention.
Especially since there's like multiple avenues of things laid on top of Gale. She's not just a psycho historian or a budding psycho historian.
Mm-hmm.
She's also a person who has precog, and she's not just a person who has these hunches and precognitions. She's also a seer, a class of people who, like, in her home planet, that's kind of their specialty, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there is a whole lot that code her as like kind of like infallible that way, but we'll see.
Yeah.
Anyway, Ari moves on and says, so what's the Invictus doing here? Maybe, just maybe, it's still piloted by a now somewhat older and grizzled Captain Hugo, still alive through the use of cryo-sleep mm-hmm. tanks, and in search of Hardin, who he had tracked down via the last known coordinates of his old ship, the Beggar, to planet Synax, just as a second or third AI clone of Harry Seldon will inevitably say, of course he predicted it. Just a thought.
Oh, I hadn't. I was with you up until that another AI clone of Harry Seldon, but maybe.
Yeah, I mean, do you think, because that's the thing about the vast oceans of time this show is going to tackle. And we know that Goyer wants, like, you know, common protagonists and common antagonists. And we got the genetic dynasty kind of muddling around, although that looks a lot less stable than I would have thought 2 episodes ago. And they have, you know, cryo sleep and all that kind of stuff. But we are going to have to get used to a massive new cast every year, probably. Like, you're always going to have Dimmerzel, probably always have some form of Day, Dusk, and Dawn.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to, sounds increasingly likely that you're going to have a Gale and Salvor kind of duo staying together in some fashion for at least several seasons. But, like, guys like Hugo, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, he can't be around Salvor's forever.
Yeah.
And I would argue that I wouldn't even want Salvor or Gale around forever. I think part of this show, part of the books, the thing that makes it interesting to me is that intergenerational dynamic. Like the shifting of the sands is not just, oh, time passes. The shifting of the sands is the people too, right? Like the opinions, the lives of those people are very different. And how, you know, as we progress through the 1,000 years or whatever, how do we keep a plan like this on track in face of losing the people who were leading it before? I think all that stuff is what makes it so interesting to me. I don't really want a perfect through line of protagonists here. I don't want Gale or Salvor or maybe even Empire. And I think the one exception might be Harry Seldon himself to kind of,
and when you
take
say
us
himself,
through this
you
story,
mean like some kind of in, you know, AI
copy of him, yeah,
because he's yeah.
Right. Just yeah, that representation of Harry Seldon. I don't want a whole bunch of protagonists that I stick with through this entire series, which is weird to say because in almost any other series I would want that. This is the exception. I think it becomes a more interesting show if you get, like, you know, a season or two of a protagonist that we know. And then somewhere along that way, they obviously hand torches to other people. And what do those people do with those torches? That's the interesting part of this. So I hope they don't stray too far from that.
Yeah, it's kind of like I kind of agree that, like, I expect there to be kind of like mini duologies and trilogies, like, you know, the first two or three seasons, kind of like the way The Expanse does that too. Or maybe a better example is For All Mankind, where it's like, have some overlap, but eventually, you know, probably starting season three, a lot of the people around season one are going to be gone or irrelevant or backgrounded. And if there's a fourth season, they'll be dead.
Uh-huh.
And like, you'll have like, you know, you don't want sudden, like, complete, it's not an anthology where you have a complete disconnect between, but like, there's tons of room to bring up other characters as protagonists, antagonists, and mm-hmm. still have, like, you know, several seasons of Lee Pace holding your hand and all that. But like, yeah, Harry's the only guy, and that's going back to our previous conversation about what the fuck is up with Harry. I think that's super interesting that you've got a guy who is critiquing this static empire, always has one guy in charge, it's unchangeable, blah 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 blah, and then he sets up a foundation where he is still going to pop in and make sure that he, you know, lectures his wayward children and puts them back on the straight and narrow path. And like,
right,
he didn't train a whole army of psychohistorians to shepherd this project. No, he genetically coded himself into multiple places, and you know, that's kind of like the core, like, hypocrisy or lack of self-awareness of Harry Seldon that the show seems keen to explore.
Mm-hmm. I do think a season or two, at least, more of our main protagonist, though. So,
agreed. Yeah, I mean, I don't think they're going to. I mean, they're not going to do like a Star Wars deal and end with someone handing off the lightsaber and then. You know, like Gale and Salvor are not just going to like shoot themselves in the head and, you know, oh, I'm your daughter. Oh, I'm your mom. This is too crazy. You know, like, that's not going to happen. They're not going to completely undo all the things they did in season
one. Maybe Hugo jumps in and the tidal wave kills him. There we go.
There you go. Then Foundation.
Uh-huh.
That's the opening sequence. All right, let's move on to Joseph. Love how the finale opens up on our galaxy and zooms in on the Deliverance up against a massive star. On a second watch, I wondered if Harry's coffin was activated and transformed by that massive solar energy. Maybe it needed an intense charge like that to reconfigure into the vault. It's a very cool detail, and I found myself loving every second of its opening. That's one of the things, like, I don't think we'll ever get an answer to that.
Yeah.
But like, I kind of felt that too. It felt like the star was powering a process that was happening, but it could just be they wanted that dramatic backdrop, and it's very Phoenix like right? You know, like, he's passing through this burning ball of, or by this burning ball of hydrogen and being reborn and transformed, and it could just be all visual poetry, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then that the postscript, they said, should Lee Pace win an Emmy or what? Terrence Mann and Cassian Bilton for best supporting actor. I will say this, the Emmy people seem to hate genre stuff.
True.
Like, they didn't really start rewarding Game of Thrones for being good until it almost was bad. And then they kept on giving, you know,
right.
Peter Dinklage just kept on getting like rubber stamp this, rubber stamp. So like, it's got a real uphill battle to fight because it's just like the Academy. I think the Academy's loosened up a little bit because genre work has made them so much money. But there is this kind of like, if it's pulpy, if it's got spaceships and zombies and shit like that, well, it can't be art, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know how serious you're being, but like, I wouldn't look. The other thing is too, is always remember that the Emmys are won with a single episode submission.
Yeah.
It's not like a body of work. It's not the whole season. It's not like, it's just that you submit a single episode. And what single episode would you submit in isolation that a 73-year-old Emmy voter would see and be like, I get episode 3? Really? You're going to send somebody episode 3 and have them get all that? And are you going to send them episode, you know, the spiral one? Are you going to, like, it's a lot tougher for those performances to stand out and not look like, you know, out of place or cartoonish because you don't have all of the cool science fiction stuff understanding, you know, holding it up. So I don't know. I'd be surprised, though.
Yeah, me too.
Zach says, I was thinking about the changing of Cleon's DNA. In the previous episode, the Rebel Day said his DNA was right. Presumably the Rebels stole his DNA before corrupting the original. If the Empire didn't dispose of Rebel Day's body after death, then they could use it as a new source of pure DNA. Probably not going to happen, as it's more interesting if Empire has this genetic problem. I wonder if the Rebels could tell the Council that the DNA is no longer pure and the Rebels have pure Kleons and therefore are the rightful rulers. Could be the setting for a civil war, especially if they're power hungry members of the Council.
Oh boy. It's a real Five Kings sort of thing here. Everybody's got Kleon clones.
And I've said this about, like, you know, if they're doing the downfall of the Roman Empire, like, there is going to be an East-West schism, and there could be this war between the pure Kleons and the original Kleons and the people that are on Trantor and the pure Kleons in exile that are in some other place in the galaxy. And that seems pretty cool. And yeah, introducing this Galactic Council, like, one layer of authority that's maybe over the Empire. They're the Empire's governing with the consent of all these systems, or it is pretty interesting.
It is. Yeah, it's boy, they haven't laid that foundation yet. You know, the idea, the possibility is still out there, certainly.
That's what I'm saying about the, like, rewatch is being rewarding, because there's that line that Don said about, like, you know, when he's reviewing this with Azura in the tank, and he's like, you know, this guy, I'm no more Empire than Day, Dusk, or this guy in the tube were, because what being Empire is a genetic code. And if you can steal that genetic code and make another copy, then he's just as much Empire as anybody by Empire's own fucking words. So I think that is a little bit of a foundation.
Yeah, maybe. And ideologically, it's certainly, like, not a killing blow, but it is a blow to Empire. Like, if Kleons just start showing up in the wild, right? Like, perfect copies of Kleons. I think that is, if I were part of the public and I start seeing, you know, there are 100 people who are copies of Kleon, and they're just out, like, living lives among us. Why is Empire special again? What's the thing that separates them from us? Why are they the ruling class and we're underlings? You start to ideologically break down the, I guess, the authority and the sanctity of the Empire. That's the only way to defeat something like this, right? I mean, you're not gonna go up against them physically. Maybe the hand-to-hand thing we talked about, but you have to break down people's faith in the Empire, and that could certainly do it. That could do it, because otherwise, like, what did they accomplish, right? Because I don't think Kleon's ever going to come out and say, yep, the first Kleon is tainted and we no longer have any pure DNA to pull from, and so we're all imperfect clones of the Empire. They're not going to say that. That would be stupid. And if you get the Rebels coming out and saying, hey, we tainted the Empire's clone and they no longer have pure clones of the Empire, so they're all poor copies, who's going to believe them, right? So you have to ideologically show people that this is true. You can't just tell them that this is true.
Especially when they've said many times in the background of the show what a stranglehold the Empire has on communications. Like, they're easily able to, like, shut narratives down, put out narratives, like, drowned out, you know, things that they don't want. So it's an uphill battle for sure. And like you said, you have to probably show, not tell.
But once you do that, yeah, I mean, things start to unravel pretty quickly, I would think.
Yeah. Gene says, something psychohistory would not be able to predict, technological advances. For it to work, the galaxy must be technologically stagnant, with which what the foundation world seems to be. What's your take on technological stagnation in a empire that's been existing for over 10,000 years?
Boy, that's a good question. I hadn't really considered it. It seems like they're making technological advances. I mean, the Star Bridge is a modern conception, relatively.
Yeah, that's true. And that's the one thing that's like, yeah, that is like amazing from our perspective. But the idea that it would take 10,000 years for an empire to that has mastered folding space to be like, oh, space bridge to get stuff up and down out of low Earth orbit. Like that seems, you know, kind of anachronistic for fake future history. But I will say that like a lot of these types of books have that idea baked into it, like Dune. You know, has had 10,000 plus years of technological stagnation, you know, and it's all mm-hmm. crusted and codified. And like Star Wars, same way. When you go back to like, what was that video game? Knights of the Old, go back to the Old Republic era. They got lightsabers. They got hyperdrive. They got blasters.
They don't have Death Stars.
Like, they don't have Death Stars. No one thought of making just a giant fucking turbo laser, apparently. Yeah. But that's the thing, like that's not a new technology. It's just reminds me of in World War II, you know, the Germans would make a howitzer that's like three train cars wide and it's got 100-foot long, but it's mm-hmm. still a fucking cannon. It's just a cannon that can throw a shell 100 miles instead of 10 miles, yeah. right?
But then you have like planes and shit, right?
Advances. Yeah, real advancements. And in a galaxy, it's like once you can fold space and you can harness the power of a star, and like you could just run out of new technological advances, and then it's just commodity and making it look sexier and, you know, maybe more efficient, things like that. And I'm not sure if the empire is there yet. And also, I think there might be an idea that like the foundation, like a gathering of all the galaxy's best scientists in one place left to kind of like maybe that's something that could generate some new technology, or at least copying technology or reverse engineering technology the Empire has reserved for itself, like jump drives, like their shield technology, that kind of stuff, which would be just as valuable.
Yeah, it is interesting in a show with such advanced technology that it almost looks like magic to us. These jump drives, these bracelets mm-hmm. that can shield your entire body, stuff like that. If you're a writer, what are you coming up with that seems like an advancement on that technology?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Okay, yeah, how do you if you're working with magic, how do you and I think we have an email about that later, so we'll put a pin in that.
Okay.
Everett says, after witnessing Demerzel take Brother Dawn's fate into her own hands and claiming it was out of loyalty to the Empire, I couldn't help but consider the dynamic that exists between Demerzel and Brother Day, and how this relationship has soured over the last several episodes. Brother Day clearly felt betrayed when Demerzel chose to kneel before Zephyr Halima, and when Brother Day confronts Demerzel, claiming that her act of kneeling was an act of disloyalty, she states that if kneeling were in violation of my protocol, I would not have been able to do so, which Brother Day retorts, an explanation that conveniently justifies your actions. Mm-hmm. This interaction between the two characters began to play in my head as the knowing glances were exchanged between the two after breaking of Brother Dawn's neck, following Brother Day's ruling that Dawn has to be allowed to live. I'm under the impression that the actions of Demerzel were a direct result of Day making Demerzel kill Halima. After Dawn's execution, Demerzel states that she did so out of loyalty to the Empire, which is also an explanation that conveniently justifies her actions. One little wrinkle is like, I don't think that Day actually had ordered that he was to be alive. I think that he was having a vigorous debate with Dusk about that. And it could be that's why Demerzel jumped the gun and broke her neck, because she wasn't sure she could do it if Day gave the act of throne gave a direct order to spare him. So she took, she, you know, her little potentials of action registers took action right before the decisive was going to be closed off by one of her many overriding nested logic loops, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying. There was no, she wasn't under any standing order at that point. But also I think there's just an invisible hierarchy here. Like an order coming from Day isn't maybe necessarily what's in the best interest of the Empire. And humanity.
But the broader point here that, you know, like Goyer and his team would have to be idiots to think that we wouldn't notice, and that Empire wouldn't notice the fact that, hey, this blonde, unassuming android lady has got maybe the most power in, because like she can do whatever she wants and always justify it with, well, it's for your own good. You know, you might not be able to see it, but I can. and I'm programmed, like, you guys are more fallible than I. It's an interesting dichotomy that they are absolute powers in the universe, but there's this one lady that can at least with dawn and dusk usher them off to their death.
Yeah.
I wonder if she is truly powerless before day, though, because we've only seen her do the iron arm bar to day and dusk.
Yeah, I think day as, you know, the commanding Cleon. Yeah, probably has a lot more sway over her.
Everett also ponders, lastly, to whom is the Shadow Master truly loyal? When Dawn's differences were first uncovered by Dusk, Dawn is able to be escorted to the throne room. The Shadow Master refused an order from Dawn. Throughout the current era of Cleons, we have witnessed Dawn and Day, or Day and Dusk, act identically. The similar gestures prior to the incineration of the most recent Brother Darkness, both being right-handed, both being able to see color, and mannerisms during their meals are a few of these examples. I'm suspicious that Day's DNA has not been tampered with, but that Shadow Master is assisting Dusk in a coup that will allow him to regain power. By telling Day that he is altered and stating that Dusk is being examined, I'm predicting that it'll be said that Dusk is unaltered, pressuring Day to relinquish his rule to the only true copy of Cleon being Dusk.
Oh, boy. Okay. I can only go with the rules. Like, you can get so far off the map with this stuff. I can only go with what the show is telling me. And the show is telling me that Day is de facto empire.
He is the supreme.
And the Day is always, no matter if it's like, oh, Day has aged out and he grew up with this person, the Shadow Master, and so the Shadow Master is loyal to him. No, the Shadow Master is loyal to the commanding power of the empire, which is always Day.
It seems like the middle throne, that's their job. The Dusk's job is to chronicle and remember, and the well of experience, the call upon, but not to be discarded at Day's whim. And Dawn's job is to learn how to be Day.
Yeah.
And
I think, like, this is a scary part of this show to me. Like, how off the map are they going to get? Are they going to lean into the human drama of, you know, relationships and betrayals and shit like that with the Shadow Master and Day and these other clones? Like, how far into the weeds are they going to get with the human drama versus the rules of the empire that they've established? I think in a show that's already going to be very complex, I'm kind of hoping they lean toward, they don't have to stay completely in that lane, but lean toward the idea that we've established rules and these rules apply always. And so you're not going to get a Shadow Master who, you know, just happened to grow up with this Day. And so when he becomes Dusk, he's more loyal to that brother now. And Brother Day doesn't actually have the say here. That stuff can get so confusing so fast.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's already manifesting in stuff like this, right? Where we're speculating about who's loyal to who. And if you can keep that cordoned off to, like, Demerzel, I think that's about as far as you want to go with that shit, because it will just destroy every rule you've set up and make everything meaningless at some point.
Agreed. And we'll talk again. I keep teasing it, but we'll talk more about that here in a minute. Moving on to Andy says, hey, guys, longtime Bald Move fan and loving the show. Well, thank you. My thought is there's no way Demerzel did not know that Dawn is different. This is her 14th Cleon, raised from birth, mother, teacher, constant companion. Why did she just now choose to kill Dawn? Wouldn't her devotion to Empire lead her to off him a long time ago? If not, doesn't that mean that up till now, what's happened was meant to happen, at least as far as Demerzel's directives? And how or why does anyone other than Demerzel have access to modify or interrupt the cloning process? I think there's a chance that Demerzel herself altered the clone DNA, somehow subverting the rules of robotics by not actually causing direct harm to a living robot empire, but bumping the train off the track nonetheless. Clearly, Demerzel is feeling her own imprisonment. Is her extreme emotional reaction because her plan has failed? Because the plan has failed? That's the big question. Like, one of the big questions I have is Harry know about Demerzel? Almost certainly he does. And if he does, are they working in league somehow? Or is this just accidental aligning of goals?
Yeah.
Because I think you're right. I don't see how Demerzel, as this robot that's known all the Cleons, doesn't notice the mislaced thumbs, doesn't notice that he doesn't come back for seconds for his favorite dish, doesn't notice, you know, these little things. But she still loves Empire because I think he was born perfect and the nanobots corrupted him. So I don't know what her imperative would do with that kind of thing. That like he's still Empire, he was just corrupted, you know?
Yeah.
Like if an Empire was disfigured, like a scar, sure. like got a big facial scar or something, would they decant a new one over that?
That's a good question. I don't know. Because to maintain continuity to the populace, maybe.
Yeah.
That's an imperfection, right? That's a
Right. You're right. The first Klingon didn't get his face all fucked up, so what kind of Klingon are you if you let your grill get smashed in, bro? I don't know how they deal with that.
Well it's a visual imperfection. Yeah, it's representative of the actual lack of true power of the Klingons. I wouldn't think they'd let that stand. I don't know.
Let's move on to the Irish Monk. Says, I've really enjoyed season one and having your company along the way. Well, again, thank you. The finale is fantastic. My favorite part was Demerzel's neck break and face rip. You called it Asmovian. Goyer called it Wagnerian. To me, it was a metaphorical reveal as she took revenge on Brother Day for having to kill Zephyr Halima, as well as a literal reveal, revealing her AI body and soul. So good. Thinking back now over the 10 episodes, I think it's fair to say that the Genetic Dynasty storyline was the best element of the series. And because this is not part of the books, can we say that Goyer and his team has improved on Asimov? Is that heresy? I'd love to hear your thoughts.
They're different.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, can you improve on something that was written, 70, 80 years ago?
Sure.
With, modern day, take concept and then... Because, like, Goyer pointed this out in an official podcast, like, when Asimov was adapting the rise and fall and decline of the Roman Empire, he was thinking in terms of Cold War politics. He was thinking in terms of nuclear technology. He was thinking in terms of, the vast computing power that was just now being unlocked. And what if you could feed all of you? Those are the things that he was thinking of. It would be weird. I think it would feel so stilted and stale if they literally just made Foundation the book into a series in 2021. So I think it's fine to adapt things and take into account the new world of that we live in, where terrorism is a big thing, where, political instability is a big thing. Where maybe like the overall civilizational decline is something we're staring down, about environmental problems, that are dealt with on Synax. Like I actually like that the show is doing that stuff.
I do too.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question: who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV+, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Let's move on to Greg, who says, the beauty of a book is you get to imagine the scenes as you see fit and fill in some of the gaps you might have with your own thoughts, so it can become a thing you love. That thing is yours. You have it and it will not change, and you can have it forever. But when another creator's vision on the same story comes into play, it's always going to be different. And you add that to constraints of TV film narrative, making an adaptation that bit harder. Game of Thrones, Lord of the Rings, even The Expanse have embraced that to its advantage, and I feel this show is doing the same. For example, I love both The Expanse books and the TV show in different ways because they are different. Yes, they sell the same story, but you can explore each one in a different way, in different forms, and that's the beauty of art. I think you should stop trying to treat these adaptations as the same and embrace the differences and stop trying to compare the two formats. What do you guys think? I'm 100% on board with that because I think your examples are great. Like, I'm just now rereading book 5 of The Expanse after having seen, you know, season 5, and it's like, what I love about that is, like, it's almost always new enough that I feel like it's worthwhile reading the book. But it's also got the same. It's never like, oh, Jesus, they really zigged where the other thing zagged. Like, it's all harmony from a thematic and character standpoint. There's just differences in plot and, you know, like the fact that you don't explore people's interiors in TV and film usually, unless it's some weird art house thing, yeah. You know. So I agree. I like the differences.
Yeah, I do too. Well, as long as they're good, right? I mean,
well,
there are ways to destroy stories, and then Game of Thrones kind of being an example of both of those things, doing it extremely well, and then maybe not so well.
First, how do you adapt something that does not exist, Jim? That's the problem with the tail end of Game of Thrones. They were adapting
sure.
a book that didn't. The book series no longer existed at that point, you know?
Oh, that's fair. It's not an adaptation at that point. No, I do like changes as long as they are good and as long as they make sense. I don't know. I'm torn on this because, like, I'm watching Cowboy Bebop right now. I've watched the anime. Netflix just released the live action series. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of, you know, style and all that aside, I was kind of I wasn't super excited about it after watching the first episode because it was clear they were telling the exact same story, just with maybe like half the episodes, which meant each one covered a little bit more of the story. And they slightly remixed it. And then I got to episode 2 and I was like, okay, they're doing more with this remix. And I kind of relaxed. So I guess I don't like things that trend too closely to the book either, because then I become bored. I'm like, well, I know this story. If all you're doing, especially an adaptation from in the same medium, but from an anime, an animation to a live action thing, that seems almost pointless if you're just going to tell the exact same story. So, I don't know. I think, yeah, I do want some changes in my adaptations. I do want modernizations and interpretations through the new creators, all of that.
Yeah, and even stuff that, like, is pretty book accurate, because, like, you know, Lord of the Rings is celebrated as something that's, like, you know, pretty used closely to the plot. They did make some smart changes, like the fact that there wasn't really any compelling women characters for women
And
to give them a little bit more to do and say, and a little bit more interaction with the main characters, and a little bit more agency. Like, that just is going to, you know, play better for modern audiences. And, you know, I don't have any problem with that. But like, when I guess I do find pleasure of watching something that unfold that I know exactly what's going to happen, because I'm anticipating, like, ooh, what are the moments that are going to be awesome in my head? And I can't wait to see how awesome they are on screen. And then its reaction is like, ooh, sure, that wasn't as good as what I imagined, or ooh, that was even better. But then there's also like, I know, like, oh, there's some sticky wicket here. I don't know how they're going to visualize this part, and like seeing the ingenuity of that happening. Or again, sometimes it's like, ooh, I don't know if that's the way I would have, or I'm not sure. And I'm almost always like, when I'm criticizing it, I'm like, if I'm a person that isn't familiar with the material, do I understand what the fuck just went on?
Yeah,
and that's like why, like, I think David Lynch's Dune adaptation, for as much people like it for nostalgia, it just falls flat on its face, because there's no fucking way you can understand everything that's going on in that film if you're not familiar with the source material. It's like a visual dictionary of Dune, not an exploration of its plot and themes and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, that's just my opinion. So I think you can enjoy it both. And I guess I'm with you. The older I get, the more I kind of like when they do find ways to make it relevant and fresh. But it's always, is it good?
Of course. You know, yeah.
Is it at least as good or better than the original? That's the only way you can judge it, really.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We got a couple pieces of negative feedback. So that's where we're at in the podcast now. Alexander says, earlier in your coverage, Jim promised that the Terminus plot would get interesting as the Empire plot. Lies, all lies. Looking back on the season, it feels like two completely different shows. One is tightly plotted, full of well-acted and interesting characters, setting up conflict over a novel and a provocative idea, such as the Genetic Dynasty, and ramping it up to play off beautifully in the end. The other is a meandering and tedious plot about boringly good characters figuring out a series of MacGuffins, space crystals, and ghost ships and Rubik's Cubes, so that Jared Harris can tell them something he could have said in episode one. The voiceovers, dear God, the pretentious, blathering voiceovers. What do you say to the Alexanders and the audience?
Oh, it'll get good. It'll get good. Give it another season.
Wait till season two.
I don't know. I mean, in the book, the Terminus stuff is all there is. And a lot of the machinations that are happening are interesting. So I expect that once we get around to a fully developed Terminus, sort of adapting itself and changing into what it needs to be in any given generation or whatever, that we will also get an interesting show over there. I don't know that I would say nothing has been interesting on the Terminus side. I've liked some of the Terminus stuff. I think it is, you know, not as interesting as the Empire stuff. But I guess I would say give it more time. I don't know. I don't know. If you're looking for like that very intricate political intrigue, I don't know that it's coming from the Terminus side, because that's the generational storytelling that they're doing.
It's also a colony full of academics and like idealists.
Like, right.
It's the heroes of something are almost always less interesting than the villains. You know, Luke Skywalker is a vanilla ice cream cone compared to like Darth Vader.
Yeah.
You know? They're always, you know, and when you have, like you said, something that's this interesting and this crazy with Empire against the idealists, the space hippies and philosophers, it might come off as a little bit, And I also think there was a little bit more bumpiness in the adaptation, because they're actually trying to adapt something. Whereas the Empire, they can just kind of like, hey, we just need a much better villain to play off, so we can just go whole hog and do whatever we want there. It's probably more fun to create something from scratch than it is to try to like figure out how to get from here to there to there. But I just disagree. I just disagree that the Foundation and Terminus stuff is uninteresting and bad. I think there was a little bit more kind of maybe leaps of logic. But even then, like, I got to go back and rewatch this thing on a binge, because I just feel like that week to week I had quibbles and problems, and some of them were substantial, like, or substantiated by, like, you know, Goyer's like, well, we just didn't have the budget for this, or we didn't have the staffing for this because of COVID or that. So, like, that makes sense. And going forward, I think those things will get better. But, like, to say that the main root of the Terminus plot sucked or wasn't interesting, I guess I don't agree. There's also a lot of people saying, like, Pharaoh was bad. I don't agree with that. I thought Pharaoh was a great antagonist.
I mean, there's definitely some stuff over there that I didn't like. I don't know. It's really freaking hard to do what they're trying to do on the Terminus side, because, like I said, the book adapting that story, this is the reason why people said Foundation was unfilmable, right? That's the Terminus side of this. And I think they're getting kind of close, but you can only appreciate what's going to happen with Terminus over the span of apparently seasons of this show. Like, the interesting things happening on Terminus are not day to day, like Hugo and Salvor kissing and like ships jumping in and out. That none of that shit on that scale matters on Terminus, really. The Terminus stuff is all intergenerational changes. Like, you're going to need a lot of time for that story to develop. So they almost have to have something like Empire to keep us interested while that story is developing. Otherwise, I don't know that this show works at all.
And I also got to say that if you're saying something like all this misdirection and stuff, also Jared Harris can tell him something he could have told in episode one, that is literally not true.
If Jared Harris
had said this stuff in episode one, the Terminus people would have told him to go fuck himself. The Inacrians would have told him to go fuck himself.
Yeah, he lied to
them. The Thespians would have told him to go
fuck. To get them where they were.
Because he needed these people to do the things he wanted to do, but they would never go along with the project willingly if he told them the truth.
Right.
So, like, that's part of the bastardry of Harry Seldon, is that he does manipulate people for the greater good. And how you feel about that's different. Like, it's just not true that if he had said in episode one, hey, I'm going to take everybody out here and I'm going to lead a revolution against the Empire and I'm going to undermine. There's no way that they would have gone along with it. So, like, you've lost the plot if you think that. And I feel like I see a lot of that on Reddit, where it's like people just decided that they, and it's fine. Like, I'm not, you know, like when Jim is saying, well, you need to give an, you don't have to give a show anything.
If
the show's not entertaining you or motivating you or giving you what you need, fuck it. There's more stuff now to this ain't 1984 where we all stuck watching Knight Rider, because what else are we going to watch, right?
Right.
Like, we have choices. So don't feel like just because you're a sci-fi fan and you love Foundation as a kid that you got to love this series. Like, bail on it if it's not bringing you. But, like, I would suggest that, like, your problems with this show are such that it's interfering with your ability to understand what the show is trying to do. Because the conclusion you draw at the end here is just, it's just not what the show is. It's not the story the show is telling. So,
yeah. And I honestly feel like
you want to check out, and that's cool.
Season one is just like an episode one for that story too, right? Like, lying to them, getting them here is just the tip of the iceberg for that.
Yes. Let's move on to Ryan from Australia. In general, I'm loving the show, but I'm somewhat skeptical of the interplanetary diplomacy in episode 10. When Harry emerges from the vault, he has a 10-minute chat with 25 Inacreons and 25 Thespians who know in no way represent the millions of people back home without any real authority, the rank of starship captain or equivalent, and suddenly a new alliance forms. I mean, that's like two small army units on the India-Pakistan border having a chat, and suddenly both nations forget all their history, wars, hatreds, and start a new chapter. Okay, is that actually true? Because we had the Grand Huntress of Inacreon leading this band. Like, this is essentially saying, like, if you had a Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and their, you know, like the retinue of bodyguards and the cabinet of the United States somewhere, and Joe Biden dies, that, like, it's Kamala Harris couldn't step in and, like, you know, I mean, I don't know how popular that would be, but, like, legally
yeah, or not.
it would not be strange, right? Like, again, like, this is the, like,
She wasn't some rando rebel from Anacreon. She was their Grand Huntress.
I think the Thespian side is a little, I understand Mercier, where you're coming from. Sure. That's Mercier, because who is this dude? Is he the Grand Huntress of Thespian? I don't know.
But also, who would Thespians send to, like, as Hugo said, like, I got the Grand, you know, I got this and that. Who would they send? Would they send some, like, person with no authority or no, like, you know, if they send an equivalent of a 4-star general, they're going to have a hell of a lot of authority to handle the stuff. So, like, yeah, I get it. I get a little bit. And I even had that problem, too. Like, I would have liked to seen Jared Harris as Harry Seldon have a little bit more proof rather than a theory. But even with this Indian-Pakistan border, if, like, somebody popped out, you know, I don't know, Noam Chomsky died 30 years ago predicting that there'd be this massive, you know, geopolitical destabilization of the American empire in the 21st century. And fucking Noam Chomsky pops out of a hologram in the Indian-Pakistan border and be like, why are you guys fighting? It's been America manipulating you the entire time. You're saying that wouldn't be a story that they're, like, predisposed to believe? Like, I think that's a story that would have a lot of, especially if there was, I don't know, a fucking fleet of B-52 bomb, whatever the fuck, I can't even remember, the stealth bombers that had just been uncovered in the desert. And he's like, yeah, and all these people can help you fix them up, and then you'll have new, like, I again, like, are we engaging with the story on its own terms, or do we have some kind of thing that we think the story has to be doing and we're just not engaging with it? I don't know.
Well, I'm gonna push back a little bit on that. I think the show just didn't show us the things that would be necessary to show us for us to believe this stuff, right? It just shortcuts it. It has to, because the story is so big. So, like,
and I will agree with that too. Yeah,
yeah, because they could have sat down. Like, the Expanse does a lot of this stuff, right? Sits us down in rooms where people argue over what they're gonna do next, and we could have done all that. We could have spent an entire episode with the Thespian government saying, hey, here's the story that Harry told us. Do we believe it? What are we going to do about it? The show's just shortcutting that. And, like, yeah, it might not feel as satisfying. I get it. But I'm just going to go along with it, because I know that the larger story they're telling here is the point, not these micro stories. But yeah. I get it if you don't want to as well.
Yeah.
If you just think it sucks.
You know, one of the questions I want to ask Goyer tomorrow is, like, you know, what were your big takeaways? What are your big learning? You know, what are things you think, you know, what's like one thing you think you crushed? What's one thing you think you could do better? Because I'm sure, like, the experience of making this, it was almost a 4-year experience that was interrupted by some COVID stuff and, you know, some real limitations in, like, travel and who they could get and who they could network with and how connected the writers could be. And sounds like some of that will still affect season 2, but still I'd expect a professional team to learn from those limitations and maybe missteps. And I want to see what he says about that. But, like,
sure,
I don't think season 2 is going to be, like, perceptibly worse. At least that's not the hope. You know, the hope is, like, OK, well, there's limitations of working remotely. How can we work around those? How can we better interface with experts and fields so that we get the science right? How can we? You know, like, I think it will be better because they'll learn from the experience of telling the story from this first season.
Yeah, I hope so.
So, yeah. All right, let's have one final email from Alex. Says, I was surprised to hear you say the answers that we got to our questions in the finale were satisfying, because I think the Klingon stuff is great and I'd watch the show if that's all there was, but the Terminus stuff seems weak by comparison. That's what everybody says about the show.
Mm-hmm.
The show seems completely uninterested in actually explaining how things happen, is content with just hand-waving them away as unimportant. I can already hear Jim saying sufficiently advanced technology, blah, 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 magic, but I'm an avid fantasy reader, and even magic still needs rules built around that magic, or there aren't enough stakes to make the story compelling. A couple of my issues with the finale. First, we get no explanation on how Harry knew that Invictus was going to be conveniently located at the edge of the galaxy near Anacreon. Like, I feel like they did. The man's an expert at predicting things. This was one of the first projects he did, and he successfully predicted it.
Well, my headcanon on this is not that he had predicted specifically that this would absolutely happen, that, oh, it's going to be exactly right here, and I know this. My headcanon is that he has predicted a variety of potential outcomes, and having seen that the Thespians and the Anacreons were all gathered here. He knew that something along those lines had happened. And so his AI is, you know, shunting its programming and its new predictions over into that possibility space, I guess. That's kind of how I'm reading it. Is he has predicted a lot of things, and whichever of those things happens, he's now predicting new predictions based on the things that he knows have happened, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. He says also, secondly, we get no explanation for how they managed to get the Invictus to stop jumping, which is a huge cliffhanger from the previous episode. All we get is a single throwaway line from Hugo that they took care of it. I'm supposed to believe that traitor smuggler Hugo was able to easily solve the problem with the jump drives on his famous ancient jump ship. A problem that apparently nobody on the original Invictus crew could actually solve. Okay.
Again, did they say
are
he
we actually engaging with the plot? Because here's what I saw. I saw an 18-month montage of the best technicians from Terminus working together with a motivated crew of Anacreons and Thespians to solve this problem. And I also saw the original crew of Invictus torn apart by some kind of crazy civil war and coup and mutiny brought on by some exogalactic threat. I don't think the idea was the Invictus was like irretrievably broken and no one on the ship knew how to fix it. I think the story was that something batshit crazy happened and the crew mutinied. And that's why
it
was stuck.
And it didn't have
a
navigator and it was, yeah.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. And then, well, maybe that's what maybe the ultimate thing that caused the thing to ultimately break down. But like the captain was barricaded in the bridge, holding off a determined attacking force of the rest of the ship. So it wasn't like, oh, the fucking engine stopped working and the, you know, engineers are sitting with their thumbs up their asses. Like, is this a plot hole or is this like you stopped paying attention around episode 5 and started hate watching the show? Which, hey, man, I have a lot of fun with that on The Walking Dead. I can't recommend it highly enough.
Sure.
But it's not the actual story that's being told here.
Yeah.
So I said, finally, and most egregiously, considering that it's been part of the plot since the first episode, is the issue of the null field. Again, we're given a single line or maybe two about the null field just being part of the vault's protection system. No explanation for why it's expanding, no explanation for why it didn't seem to affect Salvor, no explanation for why it's a seemingly good idea to risk killing everyone on Terminus before the vault could be opened. Much like the Invictus, there just isn't any good in-world reason given for the vault to generate a null field in that way, except for the plot required it.
I mean, a lot of this stuff is either stuff they haven't answered yet or stuff that I think you're supposed to fill in the blanks for yourself, right? Like, Gale being the mother of Salvor, the DNA coding on the fence stuff. Like, there's a lot of sort of around the edges storytelling here that I think we're supposed to understand, but I'm not sure about that. I'm not going to say that this was a perfectly told story either. Some of your complaints are valid. I think they are shortcutting things pretty massively, but I don't know. I think you can fill in some blanks for yourself in a story.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, about the null field, again, the plan was for Gale to be there. And
exactly. That's
Gale
why I say
to, you know, have spent 30 years working on psychohistory, maybe, and kind of understanding better her role in it. And, you know, it's just kind of like, and I could say I have a huge problem because it seems like Harry's right, despite all these ass pulls and ass grabs and random things happening and like, oh, it's a good thing that Gale had a kid or everyone on Terminus would have died. Like, but I don't know. Cause I don't know if this was part of Grant, you know, Harry's double secret, triple grand conspiracy, or there is a little bit of like, you know, psychohistory being stronger than even he knows, because no matter what happens, it always kind of ends up working out. Or, I don't know, because like it does bother me a little bit that Harry's calling audibles like on the eve of his death and doing that stuff. But like, you know, this is a mystery. This is part of the mystery, the vault and what's in it and why it's opening and all that kind of stuff. And I don't think we're supposed to fully understand, you know, everything at the end of season one. But like Jim said, you know, this isn't a perfect show. I don't think it's telling all of its stories perfectly.
Yeah.
But like, I also see that there's a lot of people having problems with this show that I think are not necessarily there, you know,
Like, and not giving it the benefit of the doubt, not having the patience to let the story tell the story it wants to tell.
Yeah.
Just expecting it to hand you everything immediately. I don't know.
Yeah.
We've got hopefully a lot more seasons of this show. I think they'll get to some of these questions. But also it's good that, you know, people are asking these questions, because I think, you know, any writer who's going to be paying attention to the questions fans are asking might be more inclined to answer those questions in the future. And, you know, take the feedback, both positive and certainly negative, into account for future seasons. So hopefully the show will get better. Like you said, with the COVID stuff, there were problems just logistically that probably affected a lot of this, but I don't know. I expect the show to get better as it goes.
Agreed. So that's going to be it for this week, or for this week's, or actually this season's feedback. We will have one more episode that is a conversation with Goyer, where we sat down and we got a couple of questions to propound him from from me and Jim's ideas. We also got a couple of people that took us up on the offer to ask him some questions through feedback. That'll be out sometime, I'm certain, soon after this episode is released. But you got that one last thing to look forward to. And again, if you like epic science fiction, I cannot recommend The Expanse highly enough on Amazon's Prime Video. And we are going to be, I think we'll have a preview of season 6 out, not next week, but the week after. And then the week after that, The Expanse is upon us. In fact, it might even be a week earlier than that. I think it might be the preview is out next week. Okay.
Yeah.
I think you're right. So, and guess what? Jerry Harry features prominently.
Well,
and at least the he's early been gone for a while. Expanse.
Yeah.
If you're missing some Jared Harris and you want to see him speaking in an outrageous belter accent, then check out The Expanse and check out our podcast on it, Belt to Loda. Or as I suggested, search for Bald Move Pulp and subscribe to that feed, and you can get all of our science fiction, fantasy takes. Because there's a ton of stuff coming up, man. There's a new Amazon project for Lord of the Rings next year. There's the prequel series for Game of Thrones, House of the Dragon. There's The Boys, The Expanse. We're going to be doing reviews of Spider-Man, No Way Home, and the new Matrix Resurrections.
Oh, yeah.
Tons of stuff coming up just in the months ahead that I think you guys will really like. And you can find it all by subscribing to Bald Move Pulp. That's where all of our pulpy science fiction fantasy podcasts get grouped up. So check that out. Thank you. Regardless of whether you loved it or hated it, I really appreciate everyone that took a chance on our new podcast. And. Mm-hmm. Listen to us week by week. Looking forward to talking to Goyer and coming back for season 2 next year. Hope to see you there. Everybody coming out of the cryopods at the same time. And look forward to that. Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.